Welcome to the Student Housing Insight Podcast, where we're putting you in touch with the people that bring student housing to life. And this episode is sponsored by StudentHousingSites.com. StudentHousingSites.com is owned by Mike Spencer. Mike is putting a new face on the process of locating land in student housing markets. And Mike's doing that by crowdsourcing the process. So go check him out at StudentHousingSites.com. So welcome to the podcast, guys. Today's going to be a little bit different because I am bringing in a new co-host. As I mentioned in a previous episode, giving a preview as to what was happening this fall, I mentioned that we were going to be bringing on not only Greta Dare, but also someone with an on-campus background, who is Dr. April Hicks Konvalinka. April, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Wes. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, great. Well, listen, I want to make sure that the audience has a little bit of an understanding of your background. Throughout my career, I've always stressed the importance of having relationships with on-campus administration, and these off-campus properties tend to work so much better when there's that relationship and folks are working hand in hand on delivering the mission of the university, as well as, you know, what the off-campus properties are trying to succeed at as well. But anyway, give a little bit of your background for our listeners so they've got a good understanding of your experience.
Sure, I'd be happy to share my professional experiences. So I have worked in higher education, more specifically in housing and residence life, for over 20 years. And during this time, I have served at an executive level, managing a comprehensive housing program at a large public institution. I oversaw a business operations and facilities area at a medium-sized institution for a little over 13 years. And during that time, I was responsible for growing a maintenance program from the ground up and overseeing 7 residence hall construction projects that were funded through the university. And early in my career, I started out on the residence education side of housing and then chose to go to the business operations facilities as I moved further into my career. So I would say I have a demonstrated track record in residence life, student development, and teaching, facilities management side of the house of housing. Residence life, in which I've spent many, many years focusing on campus design and development projects and ensuring that we're providing living environments that are conducive to student academic success.
Very cool. I think that's going to bring that experience is certainly going to bring a very unique perspective to our listeners. So I appreciate you agreeing to join me in this venture with this podcast, and looking forward to finding out more details about your experience and the things that you've learned. For our listeners who are interested in a career track in on-campus housing and on the administration side for the university, as I was introducing you, obviously you've got doctor at the front of your name, so that doesn't come easy. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably a little surprised as to how much education someone has to have to work in those type of positions that you've been in. So if you could explain a little bit of your education background in order to try to illustrate a track that, for those of our audience members who are interested in pursuing that, they've got some kind of idea of what that takes.
Sure. So I did not wake up and decide that I was going to work in higher education. I actually I actually fell upon this profession as a student at Western Carolina University. I was a biology major and graduated with a degree in Bachelor of Science in Biology. And during my time at Western Carolina, I became involved as a student leader and then became an RA, a resident assistant. And then from there, moved up to hall director and then decided to pursue a career in higher education from that experience. I was not aware that this was even a profession. I was on a trajectory to become a physical therapist. And then through that experience as an RA, a resident assistant, that really opened up the door to this career that I have been in over 20 years.
You know, April, it's funny that you mentioned that RA experience is, you know, what kind of changed that career trajectory for you. It's funny, last week on the podcast between Greta and I, that was mentioned as well, is that so many people in this industry, regardless if it's off campus or on campus, end up having that resident assistant or community assistant, as it's commonly referred to off campus. They have that experience. They really get a kick out of the impact that they're able to have on their peers, and tend to really, as you said, fall into it at that point. So that's really cool that's how it happened for you as well. So after Western Carolina and deciding to make that change, what happened next?
So after Western Carolina, I decided that higher education was the career path for me, and pursued my Master's of Science degree in College Student Personnel from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. After leaving University of Tennessee, I worked for a couple of years, went to Arkansas State University, and then after 3 years of working at Arkansas State University, I started thinking about furthering my education again and pursued a specialist degree in community college administration, and then earned a doctorate of education during my time at Arkansas State University. And so it wasn't something that I had initially planned, but very grateful and thankful that I took that path to pursue those degrees during my time at Arkansas State.
Very cool. So that gives kind of a good highlight for our listeners on, what it takes to, from an education standpoint, to set up that type of career path. Anything that you would suggest for those that are looking to pursue that based off of your experience that you would have changed, not necessarily that you would have changed, but some advice that you would give to those that are considering that now from an education standpoint?
Sure. I think it's important if you don't have any knowledge base on the student development theory side of higher education, I think it's important to become educated on the theories and know what the theories say about students' development, because again, we're in the business to ensuring our students do succeed academically and that they graduate, whether it be after 4 or 5 years. But the developmental piece of a student is extremely important, and the living environment does impact that development. And so for individuals who maybe are not interested in pursuing a master's degree in college student personnel or higher education, you can do a little research and just become aware and educate yourself on the student development theories. I know many individuals within our profession who may not have a college student personnel degree or a higher education degree, those who have a business background or even communications background, have been extremely successful. But again, as you move up in your career, having that knowledge base, the student development knowledge base, is extremely important. Some individuals have been successful with organizational development degrees.
Mm-hmm. So April, I think that that's obviously some great information from an education track. For those other members of our audience who, they like the off-campus world and going to get their doctorate doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them right now, but they need those resources to, better understand the student theories that you were talking about and a lot of the other challenges that come up with housing college students, be it on campus or off campus. What are some good resources that you would recommend that those people go into or that those people look at?
Sure. So I would say that there are many professional resources at the state, regional, and national level that could provide the resources, educational resources, to higher education professionals or even those who are, as your audience, the majority of your audience is off-campus providers. So if you look at your state, regional levels, you can find those resources. I actually belong to ACU Hawaii, which is the Association for College and University Officers International, which is an international professional association that believes in developing exceptional residential experiences at university campuses around the world. And so the I in ACU Hawaii is extremely important because it's not just within the country, it's across the world, and the impact that we're making from a residential standpoint on college campuses. So within ACU Hawaii, there are over 1,000 member campuses and more than 250 product and service providers. And so it's a great way to connect with other professionals, service providers, and what they do on their campuses and the services that they provide to students. So it's a great way to learn from one another. If you visit the ACU Hawaii website, you will find a statement that shares, and I'm quoting this statement, that a Kuhuai provides its members with innovative, value-driven events, publications, research, career services, and online professional development, as well as valuable networking opportunities. And I find that to be a very strong statement because they are trying to evolve their members and their institutions to better serve their students and provide dynamic living environments. And so that has been a great resource for me, and would find it informative to many of your listeners.
Great. And you actually have some experience working with the Kuhuai, correct?
I do. So I have served on the executive board as the facilities and physical environments director. That was a 2-year elected appointment. So I served in that capacity and was also a founding member of the Kuhuai APA facilities conference that started back in 2002, and I've served in other capacities, chairing the Talking Stick, which is a communication resource to our members. Was on the advisory board for the Talking Stick, and then also served as the chair of the Housing Facilities and Services Committee. So I am extremely involved within Kuhuai. I find it to be an amazing resource to housing professionals and even those who are not in housing, as there are other professional associations, but I find that this is where that's the organization that I belong.
Great. Well, April, I'm glad to have you on the show. I look forward to all the background and perspectives that you're going to be able to bring. But I did record an interview this week that we should probably get to. I had David Helfrich from CW Development and Campus Works. David's been involved in the student housing arena for about 18 years now. So let's hit play on the interview. David, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Wes. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming in today. As I mentioned earlier, it's great being in Charlotte because we've got all these student housing folks that are here locally and able to come in to record the podcast in studio, which I think makes for a better interview. I think it makes for better sound quality as well. So
thanks for having me.
Thank you. So this first part of this first series that I'm doing on this podcast is really focused on those that are new to the development process in student housing. Maybe they've been a developer before, or maybe they're an owner and looking at something opportunistic in student housing and they don't know anything about it. And I was excited about bringing you on because you've got kind of a similar story of how you got involved and how you've really made a career out of the general contracting and development side. So just real quick, give us a rundown of the past 18 years.
Sure. So I started my firm 18 years ago. Really, we started as a acquisition reposition company in multifamily and did a significant amount of renovation work for large national property management firms in multifamily and regional in the Southeast, and grew in that business significantly. I think we renovated over 80,000 units, repositioned for our clients over the years. Then in the mid to late 90s, I started looking at infill construction and development opportunities. I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, found an opportunity at NC State. It was a small infill project, and really liked the metrics of student housing with the echo boomers, we're called at the time, not the millennials, the baby boomer kids, and was, you know, a unique opportunity. I was able to develop that infill project close to campus. And in 1999, I founded Campus Works, and we were a developer builder since 99. We've executed over about approximately 14,000 beds in student housing, jointly owned and acquired and disposed of over 7,200 beds over the years at 15 different universities, in excess of about $500 million worth of transactions.
Great. Who are some of the groups you've worked with?
My first partner was the Price Company, Donna Price, who has been very successful in the space. Donna was my first property manager at NC State, and on the project that I developed and built. And Donna and I formed a very early and a successful relationship in student housing. We ended up doing several projects together at NC State, Clemson University, University of Texas as well. And so we had a an opportunity to work together, her with her expertise in property management, mine with construction and development. And we worked successfully in partners, investing our own money, co-sponsoring deals, and really growing our collective brands over the years.
Awesome. So tell me about that first deal. What was the biggest thing you learned?
Well, it was interesting because of the timing in student housing and delivery is very critical. So, and having the right partners on the construction side, right, property management partners, execution is paramount. So, and if you fail to execute, then you're certainly going to be challenged in doing your next deal. And so, I think what Don and I were very successful at was proper planning and building our teams and executing our plan. That allowed us to build off each success in each deal that we did to continue to, you know, attract obviously students to our properties as well as attract investors for future deals.
Awesome. So, David, I mean, 18 years, that to some that may not seem like a lot. I'm going into my 20th year this year, and I look back at, you know, that first project that I was on, which Donna now owns, which is really kind of funny. But, you know, tell me a little bit about the, because when I look at it, I see a lot of different trends that have happened, mostly on, you know, how the students have changed, how we have to market to them differently, as well as from an operations side, especially on the technology side, some of the things that we have to do different now. But from, you know, a general contracting and development side, what are some of the trends that you've seen, and just in general, what are the trends you've seen?
Well, I think going back, Wes, to when we first started student housing, when we were developing and designing projects, we really focused on the purpose-built part of it, student housing, the bedroom-bath parity, and that really defined student housing as a asset class. Having those common areas where students could congregate and socialize was very important. The size of that clubhouse and the amenities and the pools, which you know has just been kind of an arms race, and having bigger and better amenities in common areas. But initially, I think that was very important, and that continues to be important. But also, we see, you know, the institution of, you know, furniture being introduced as in part of packages. That is now standard in a lot of communities that we do. The TVs, which was back then actually one of our first deals at NC State and Clemson, we were the first ones to put TVs in these units and really made that an appliance. That's become common space.
So tell me really quick, what did you learn? Were they mounted or were they on a piece of furniture?
We put them on the wall. We figured out, you know, how to mount them successfully, and obviously, you know, designed for all the infrastructure appropriately. So,
I won't ever forget the first time we did that was a project at Coastal Carolina, and we were including them in every room and had to be mounted on the wall.
Sure.
Even though we had a piece of furniture underneath, it had to be mounted on the wall.
Selling the sizzle, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so it wasn't just mounting it on the wall. It was making sure that there was, you know, some type of channel behind the wall to drop their wires and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And then just getting, you know, getting them mounted. I mean, it was a task.
Sure.
And it wasn't something we gave off to the GC. It was something that we did ourselves.
A lot of coordination has to go on some simple tasks. So
it does.
So, you know, obviously back the internet was very important back then, and everything was hardwired, you know, managed systems. We still put coax cable, you know, in all of our properties. We wired them ourselves. We wanted to control that infrastructure rather than having a third party control that infrastructure. We've seen, you know, megabytes, you know, what used to be a megabyte a bed, now it's a gigabyte a bed.
Yeah.
Certainly Wi-Fi throughout is standard and is necessary, and that speed and bandwidth is very important. You know, we're seeing, you know, growth in some other trends. Security is very important. As you see, large campus populations and has always been important, but we continue to focus on that. And I think the last thing, you know, you see with a lot of closer to walkability to campus, you see more mixed use and amenities of the bars and restaurants and shops, which is really a value add for the students and the parents.
They're always going to go back to campus.
Absolutely.
Always. And, you know, one thing that kind of worries me, you know, we'll get into it in one of the other questions, is the amount of value add opportunities that are coming down the pipeline and the distance those are from campus. It's, you know, you're going to be working against several different factors, because what pulled the students out to begin with was that highly amenitized package.
Mm-hmm.
Now things even closer to campus that are even infill projects have a lot of that same stuff.
Sure.
What kind of things are you looking at, and, you know, working with clients or potential deals that you want to do that may have that distance as a value add? What's that additional sizzle? Have you thought about that yet?
Well, I don't know so much. I think really what we're seeing in student housing is a bifurcation of pricing. So what you have closer to campus is obviously different construction types, different cost of land. With different construction types, type three comes a higher cost of construction, higher rents. And you're seeing that really segmentation of the product and the pricing, where the product that's farther away from campus has a value.
Yeah.
And that value, there's a large general population that are in, I'd say 70-80% that can don't have the affordability to pay those top dollars. So I still think there's certainly a value play in those space. I think you'll see a better spread between the rents between on campus and those other submarkets. What we look for in those areas for opportunities is a submarket that is well-defined, very similar to what you see in retail, the agglomeration effect, where there's other student housing, you know, properties and communities around, rather than being the outlier in, you know, the west side of campus when all of, you know, the rest of student housing is defined maybe in, you know, a different part or section of the city. You see that in Texas and Riverside, you know, West Campus, very successful. So I think there is a lot of opportunities for that purpose-built infrastructure, adding to the amenities and repositioning, you know, with, you know, some upgrades that speak to the students, but it's not, it's a different price point than you have on campus.
Yeah.
For operating efficiencies, looking at some energy and green opportunities in some of the older product with, you know, water conservation, LEDs, and there's a lot of benefit or low-hanging fruit in some of those older properties from a opportunistic standpoint of lowering your operating expenses. But I think going forward, trends going forward, is as you mentioned, some of the things you'll see in the future is the millennials obviously desired to have green, but they weren't willing to pay for it. I think the Z generation or the next generation will certainly demand it, and I believe we'll pay for that. I think really what you're seeing in the next generation is that more global citizen view of, you know, how they view the world.
Yeah. Have you guys completed a LEED certified project?
We had not. We looked at several during the run-up to the credit crisis, and those projects did not proceed forward. But since then, again, we haven't seen the value add where the students would pay for it.
And that's, beyond that part of it, do you see what other type of issues does that seem to bring up? What type of obstacles?
Well, I think what we do is we're certainly look at everything from how we position that property from a marketability standpoint. So we do Energy Star is primarily what we focus on. So it's not a full LEED certification in our new development. So Energy Stars, energy efficient appliances, low VOC paints, and all those critical things which you'd think about from a green society.
Gotcha. So, David, for the folks in the audience who are considering their first student housing development, well, let's just assume that they have experience developing other types of commercial real estate. Walk them through the things that they need to make sure a potential GC needs or needs to possess in order to be successful in delivering the project on time and within budget.
Sure. The two most important things, as you mentioned, on time and on budget. I think what you look for in, you know, a general contractor while you're doing your diligence is a successful track record of delivering on schedule. So that is very important first and foremost, because if you don't deliver on time, you're well aware of the stories in student housing of how that impacts the real estate as well as the reputation of the developer and the property.
You and I both know my former employer, Wes Bradley, and one of the things that I remember he always made the GC agree to was, if it doesn't come in on time, you're paying for the hotel rooms.
Sure.
Have you ever had to pay for hotel rooms?
Yeah. You know, we've always negotiated on, you know, and on both sides of the equation as general contractor. You know, we started doing some third-party work after 2008, but primarily we've been a builder for our own portfolio. But, you know, having liquidated damages and paying for those hotel rooms, yes, absolutely. I think that is a certain criteria of negotiating a good contract. So I would encourage anyone coming in this space to make sure that they're negotiating and have a plan in place, a contingency plan in place of how they're going to handle a late delivery. First and foremost, that is, you know, very important as you start off in your construction, because if you don't have a plan, certainly plan to fail on that side.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think looking at the financial resources of a general contractor, bonding is certainly important, or some type of financial guarantee from the general contractor. The other thing, as you mentioned on budget, is trying to get to that pro forma budget that you have on the beginning of the project and conceptual pricing to come in your GMP. So finding a contractor that has a very strong regional presence or national presence, are able to leverage their resources, have a pre-construction department that can review those plans and drawings, and ensure that they are bringing in that project on budget is very critical.
At what point would you suggest, because the way I see most developers approach a new project is they go to, it ends up going to an architect before it ever gets to a general contractor. And obviously there's reasons for that. Mm-hmm. The GC doesn't know how to price it without plans. But is there any value that a GC is able to give to a developer? And of course, you've done both the development and the GC side, and maybe it's more of a third-party consultant developer that gets involved. But let me go back and ask the original question. Do you think there's any value of having a GC, even if it's just from a straight hourly fee, be a part of that process prior to actually bidding on the project?
No, absolutely. The most successful projects that I've seen and that I've been involved with is having the general contractor involved early, whether that's some form of pre-construction services, but having them engaged at conceptual design can add value. Obviously, through the design set and the construction drawings is critical. I think there's a lot of people have a school of thought that they want to design the entire project and then go competitive bid it with three contractors. More often than not, I think they find out as they've over-designed a project or they didn't coordinate the drawings properly, and they end up with a higher price that they have to try to value engineer at the 11th hour, rather than engaging a contractor early in a negotiated bid basis and working with them through that entire process.
Now, does the CW Construction provide those type of services?
Absolutely.
Okay. Great.
We've done consulting for third parties. We've obviously been engaged in a negotiated basis, and certainly on our own deals, we're involved very early in that design phase.
Okay. So this is the part where you pass the torch on to others and let them know the hard lessons you've learned. Give some examples of when something went wrong with purpose-built student housing delivery that could have been avoided, and what did you learn from it?
Well, there's probably a lot of lessons learned, Wes. I think some of the biggest things maybe came to mind recently is in dealing with some of the third-party clients is exactly what I mentioned. They're designing their product in a vacuum, and they're not really engaging that general contractor early in that design or development phase. I think the value add to do so far outweighs the value of a competitive bid process at the on the back end. And remember, what you're getting with a general contractor, you can negotiate their fee in general conditions, but the rest of the project, the other 90% of the project, is competitive bid from a subcontractor basis and should be involved in that subcontractor bidding and selection process. But some of the things I've seen at third party is the design drawings weren't fully vetted. We've had projects recently that had 400 RFIs. We've had a stoppage of work because of design coordination issues with structural and architectural not matching. And that really impacts student housing because it's so schedule constrained. And when you have to stop what you're doing as a general contractor and really design the project as you're going, it really impacts the subcontractor efficiency, and you lose valuable days. And those are days you can't make up in student housing.
Yeah. So that's a good transition to something else I wanted to ask. I've been involved in situations where, we located a phantom pond on a site before, and we had to completely switch the way we were going to be delivering the project, and hurricanes that just didn't want to ever leave, kind of like what happened with Harvey. Nothing to the extent of Harvey, but, it ends up causing these huge delays.
Sure.
I've seen some pretty creative things as far as building walls and high school gymnasiums and things like that. Any type of any type of thing like that you've come across?
We've been very creative. So there's been times where you have those unknowns. You hit rock in certain areas you didn't anticipate. You hit water tables, right, where you didn't anticipate. There's been, you know, a lot of projects where we had that we had planned on building the clubhouse first, because that's the idea, to deliver the clubhouse, the amenities. And in those areas, it gets, you know, your construction schedule gets flipped and you're working now backwards. We've had instances where you got behind on maybe some soil conditions, where we actually started building the buildings before you had the roads in, which really doesn't make sense. Yeah, you want to have roads to operate around your building. So there's a lot of creative things that you can do and need to do in student housing, because, again, with a constrained schedule, you have to find any way to, you know, to make your schedule.
Yeah. You know, 6 to 8 years ago, I felt like, you know, most, if you were building a garden style, you know, kind of cookie cutter type building, that, you know, as long as you got through entitlement and everything on the planning department, I should say, was on time with what they were doing. If you could break ground in October, November, you could deliver in August, you know, depending on the size of the project. Mm-hmm. I don't see that anymore.
Yeah.
Is that just because the contractors that have gotten involved are demanding more time, or does it have more to do with it's not just that cookie cutter 4-bedroom, 4-bath, 12-unit building?
I think it's several reasons, and back to, again, having a good plan and giving yourself enough time to start, and starting on time and understanding what you need to build. The first thing is the construction types. So when you're, you know, if you're doing a garden style project, you have multiple buildings you can work on at any one time. So your critical path can, you know, obviously you can work, if you have a delay on one building or design a soil, you can work on other buildings. When you're dealing with these smaller footprint jobs, type three, that are mid rises, which is a lot close to campus, you're layered now. So it's right on top of each other. So if you have a problem on the foundations, you can't build the floors above it.
Right.
So that obviously constrains you. The other thing is, since, you know, remember wood frame type three construction, which is over five stories, or five, you know, over four stories, that is new in a lot of municipalities over the last probably 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. So that construction type, and these municipalities understanding it, each of them view them differently. So that design process and inspection process is different. So those are also challenges that need to be overcome. And then the last thing is the labor shortages and people that know how to build these buildings, you know, efficiently. You're dealing with, you know, structural steel in some cases, and structural concrete. You're not just looking at your typical spread footing. You're now dealing with a structured parking garage and wrapping it in wood, or you know, going underground subterranean, and then, you know, building four stories or five stories of stick on top of it. So it's much more complex.
Moving closer to campus, and then, you know, having to integrate structured parking into that. But would you suggest a developer having a separate GC for the, or, yeah, I guess you'd say a separate GC for a parking deck, assuming that it's not, I mean, obviously if it's built within the building, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but.
Yeah, we recommend that a developer have one general contractor that's responsible for the total package. So I've seen some before come to us and say they'd like to break out site work, for example, and have someone come in and do the grading and be responsible for that, and we'd like you to build the buildings. And I think that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Because, again, that coordination between the grades, the elevations, that site work contractor, and the vertical construction is very important. And if it's not managed appropriately, then it's very difficult for a developer to hold someone accountable.
Yeah. I will say I did a project one time that had it was the most grandiose clubhouse we'd ever done. And it was literally a custom home. Mm-hmm. And that was a situation where I wish we'd just gotten a separate general contractor to do the clubhouse and the leasing office, because it was, and for, that was also the same site that had that phantom pond. So you can imagine where the GC's attention was at. It was not on delivering the amenity package.
I mean, I think to your point, Wes, it's, again, back to planning. Ensuring when you're laying out your site and your construction schedule as a development plan that you're focusing on those amenities first.
Yeah.
Because, as you point out, it's like building a custom home. So if you're waiting to build that last, you're setting yourself up to a very constrained schedule with very detailed finishes.
Yeah.
The ability of starting that earlier gives you that that float in the schedule to get it right.
Yeah. The first deal I ever worked on was what's now 49 North, that Donna has. And you guys did a rehab on that,
we
correct?
We did, yeah. We purchased it with Donna.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you, I knew you were on
We developed and built. Yeah, we built U-Village, Don and I, together with Harrison Street, and we purchased, it was University Club, which is now 49er. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, so we, when we opened, so I was part of the lease-up team for that original project, and there were two move-in dates, August 1st and August 15th, and we had, I don't know when they broke ground, I was hired in May, April or May. And the leasing trailer had only been open for a couple of weeks. So that gives you some idea on how behind they were on that project. But in addition to that, they had to completely ignore the amenities. And on move-in day, it was nothing more than that clubhouse with a roof over it. And the swimming pool had been dug. I don't even think concrete had been poured. And so we had TCOs on everything, and
heads and beds.
Yeah, we actually had we actually did our assembly line move-in day in that shell of a clubhouse. So, anyway, so when does it make? I mean, you've been involved with on the ownership part on a lot of these deals, and not just been third party. But when do you think it makes sense for an owner to consider a GC as a possible JV partner? And what advice would you give to a developer who is considering that type of relationship?
Well, I think there's a lot of value in it. You know, certainly there's advantages and disadvantages of both, but there is value. Having a vested partner in the schedule, in the delivery, especially if you're a new developer in the space, it allows you some guarantee of success because you have a vested partner. So I think there are some merits. You know, having a construction partner, especially in these times where there's a lot of labor shortages and potential material escalations with the hurricanes and when things get tight, you have a general contracting partner that is aligned with your interest. So they have much more flexibility to bring labor to your site, you know, obviously secure materials, and I think it could be a big advantage.
Any other advice on those type of relationships?
You know, certainly I think you still need to consider and treat them like a third party as well, in the same token that they have to be accountable for liquidated damages, and they have to be responsible for delivering that portion of the budget and the schedule. So, you know, where they have an interest in the real estate, they're paid for that benefit and the success of the real estate, that alignment, there still has to be a very defined relationship in their contract that they're responsible for the delivery of the budget and delivery of the schedule.
So for the general contractors that may be out there listening, any advice that you would give them on approaching that type of relationship?
Some advice I'd give a general contractor is, again, when you're involved in that part of the project. So if you're brought in when a plans and drawings have already been designed and you're just pricing those, you have to be careful because now you're responsible, or you own everything in those that set of drawings, which you should as a general contractor. Mm-hmm. But obviously having some input in that process, if you're brought in early to that process, which would be my desire if I was a general contractor, being asked for a developer to be involved in a project, would be involved in the inception of the design phase.
Good, good. All right. So there is $1.7 billion of CMBS loans that are set to mature in 2023, and 20% of those are currently on the watch list. And this has been a recurring theme throughout this first series, just kind of preparing everybody for the wave of this stuff that is coming. So, you know, this will likely result in a lot of value-add opportunities in the sector. You got started in student housing with a lot of renovation projects and still do a lot. For the audience members who are evaluating these type of opportunities, what are two or three things that you would advise those buyers to consider?
I guess first and foremost would be to have some dry powder. So, you know, have the funds and the capital partners lined up so that you could capitalize on those transactions when they become available, and have a team in place that can do the proper, you know, physical due diligence and the management due diligence necessary to close. So that I think will be critical. The people that are successful have the infrastructure already in place when those opportunities arise. The second is looking for good locations, as we talked about. You know, walkability to campus is important. However, it's not critical to be successful in student housing. You know, almost 90% of our portfolio, which we've been huge, you know, very successful in 98% of it being leased, is probably more than a mile away from campus. So finding good, strong submarkets, as we talked about, having, you know, transportation, you know, accessibility to campus, being around shops, restaurants, all those create values. So looking at those submarkets and underwriting those is very important. And then getting understanding the physical infrastructure of the buildings, having the Bed Bath parity and purpose built is very important. And everything else can be upgraded or changed, but some things.
Right. Yeah, the plumbing's always hard to change after the fact. Let's stay on that for just a second. What's kind of the, and I know you don't want to get specific in cost, but just, you know, ballpark or give some type of, just interested in your response here. If you come across one of those opportunities where you don't have bedroom bath parity, mm-hmm. what's the typical cost? What are some of the things that they need, that a developer needs to understand is going to come with that?
If you're trying to convert it?
Yes.
It really depends, would probably be the answer. Depending upon, obviously, this, you know, a lot of them are challenging or could be challenging because of you know, how old they were built. Now, obviously, the structure point loads and what walls you could move or couldn't move, you know, what type of piping that you have. The cost could be significant. I think a lot of developers kind of shy away from doing that conversion and trying to make it a Bed Bath parity. But you know, you could be looking at, you know, 10 to 15,000 a unit just on that portion of the upgrades.
Okay, assuming that there's some type of space within the unit mm-hmm. that, you know, so that you're not going to have to punch a wall out or anything like that. I think that's really kind of the, because there are some opportunities out there, because some of this product that was built 10 years ago, you know, had some pretty large rooms, some pretty large closets, and some of that could mm-hmm. be taken away to.
Add a sink,
maybe a you know, closet for the toilet, that mm-hmm. that type of thing. So
I think the other thing I would consider is, as it talked about, having a good team, looking at that physical due diligence of the asset. You certainly want, a lot of these older properties are aged, there could be deferred maintenance, so you want to have a team that can certainly look at the physical asset and that you're not buying someone else's problem or deferred maintenance. I think a lot of developers make the mistake that they rely on the canned you know, property assessment report that is done by an engineer rather than looked at by a true general contractor or a construction team that can come in and really assess the condition of the asset. When we look at assets for acquisition, we'll actually bring in a structural engineer, a mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineer. So we'll take, you know, measures in excess of that typical PCA to really look and see, you know, what our potential exposures were, as well as opportunities.
What we touched on this in my last episode regarding choosing a management company, and one of the dealing with this basically same type of question about value add properties. One of the things I express to everybody on that is to make sure that you're not, when you're doing those things, when you're doing those rehab projects, that you're not setting up a project, you know, someone on site, you know, a property manager, maintenance supervisor, that becomes the de facto project manager for the owner. What kind of advice would you give to an owner that's going to do a rehab project? From their standpoint, as far as managing the general contractor that's involved?
Well, you know, obviously planning and communication is very important. I mean, there will need to be a liaison between the general contractor and the property, which is important, but also the communication with the residents and planning with the residents, so they're well aware of what's going on as you're transitioning the property and being attentive to their needs and the customer service. But you do need to have some on-site management from a general contractor, a project manager that's running point over those subcontractors on the job. So again, just very simple, you know, planning, communication, regular meeting schedules to ensure that, you know, those expectations are being met and communicated to the residents.
All right, David, that's all the questions I've got for you. So how can folks get a hold of you, David?
Yeah, they can contact us at campusworksdevelopment.com or email us at info@cwonsite.com.
Very important to remember that CW onsite, because I sent emails to David for a period of time that never got to him because I used the website address.
If you Google Campus Works, I'm sure you'll find us.
Yeah. Well, David, I appreciate it. And I think this is a lot of great information for folks that are considering that. This is going to be coming out before NMHC in Tampa, and I'm sure some of the listeners will be there. You going to be there?
I will, absolutely.
Right. Well, great. So if you're there, guys, make sure you look David up and talk to him about any projects that you've got going on. Well, guys, that was my interview with David, and I hope you were able to take a lot away from it. Just to highlight a few takeaways that April and I have, let's jump into those really quick. April, what were the takeaways you had?
So I would say the first takeaway would be execution is paramount.
Yeah, having partners that, you know, as David explained, that understand that and that are properly prepared to execute is everything when it comes to delivering on time and making sure that, you know, the product is going to meet all the expectations that have been, you know, built up for everybody.
The second takeaway that comes to mind was making sure that your general contractor has a regional footprint.
Yeah, leveraging those resources when a GC's got those that regional footprint, being able to, you know, resource things if, you know, in the 11th hour something happens, and you know you want to have someone that's connected to that region that you're building in. And then the other thing was just the pre-construction part, you know, having a GC that is, maybe they're not the ultimate GC that you end up picking, but making sure that you've got a GC that's part of that design process, I think really helps with any of the value engineering that has to happen, and making that happen on the front end versus the back end, I think was extremely important. Anything else?
Yeah, a third takeaway would be build your leasing center and amenities first. You think about those first before anything else.
Yeah, I've given a couple experiences to our listeners about when that hasn't happened, and on developments that I've been involved with. So, yeah, definitely make sure that you can do that. I think also, you know, getting back into the value add type assets, and when you're acquiring an existing asset, you know, don't just send the engineers in to do the due diligence. If you plan on doing a rehab, make sure that you're bringing in a GC as well, because that's only going to get those surprises out of the way early as far as what type of pricing you're going to be looking at when renovating, especially inside the units. So, great interview. Well, April, I appreciate you being on the podcast today and helping me with this. And again, look forward to the perspectives that you're going to be bringing. If there's anybody in the audience that wants to get in touch with you to ask any other questions, what's the best way for them to contact you?
So if anyone would like to connect with me, they can just send me a message through LinkedIn. My LinkedIn is April Hicks Konvalinka, and that's K-O-N as in Nancy, V as in Victor, A-L-I-N as in Nancy, K-A.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it.
Wes, thanks for having me. I look forward to future podcasts with you.
Yes, thanks, April. I appreciate you coming on. And for all of our listeners, I want to mention again, this episode is sponsored by studenthousingsites.com. If you are looking for land opportunities in student housing markets, or even if you're a broker and want to speak with Mike about possibly partnering with his site to post land opportunities that you have, please go to studenthousingsites.com, check that out, and leave your contact information for Mike to contact you. Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Great week.